Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did schools get so loud and busy, and what are students trading away for the purported benefits of group work and constant discussions about what they are learning? During the year she was working as a New York City public school teacher, writer Diana Seneschal grew concerned that with all the bells and whistles of 21st century education strategies, today's students are not learning the simple skills of sitting still, contemplating a lesson, and developing their own ideas. She writes about her observations and makes a case for more individual thinking during the school day in her forthcoming book, Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture. She's in town today as winner of the 2011 Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture and will give a lecture to the organization tomorrow night. Diana, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be here.
So how do you define, for purposes of this discussion, how do you define solitude?
That's an interesting question. I would define it as an ability to step back from the urgencies of the moment. So many people define solitude as physical removal from others, being away, being out in the woods. But that's a little bit limiting because then it would be a physical condition and not much more. And some people define it as loneliness or something negative. Some people define it as sheerly positive aloneness. And all of this I find constricting. I would say solitude is part of our lives at all times. There is some aspect of us that is alone, but we can honor it or not. We can learn how to shape it or not. And one way to shape it is to step back from the constant updates and think about what's going on and to learn to appreciate the past as well as the present. And to take time with a book that was written many hundreds of years ago without worrying about whether or not we're receiving email, for instance, or what someone might have posted just now on a blog.
The interesting thing about those constant updates, especially from the perspective of children, is it takes the form not only of sort of social approval, but they start to lose touch with the ability to evaluate their own work and their own ideas. They're waiting for either a teacher to say right or wrong or the group that they're working in to sort of approve this as the thing they're going to put forward.
This is true, and it happens in so many subtle ways all around us that it is difficult to gauge this change. Even in the past few decades, I believe we've become much more dependent on other people's reactions and instant reactions. We have less of that sense that the value of something comes clear over time or that we may not have the right answer right away or ever. Instead, we are trained to find out what others think right now, and to value what others think right now, to value popularity votes in the moment, to value approval or disapproval in the moment, and then to shape ourselves subtly to get more votes, to get more approval.
Even the idea that there is always a right answer is constricting in a way.
The question is not the problem. Sometimes there is a right answer. I do believe that 2 + 2 = 4.
Sure,
I do
sure.
believe that. And in more complex levels, too, I do believe that there are right answers, however many uncertainties one can find. But the problem lies in equating what people like or what people want with the right answer and or what gets the highest ranking with the best. And in schools, we see this with the emphasis on test scores. The higher the test score, supposedly, the better at the education. And test scores do tell us something, and they are important in their place, but one must keep them in their place. One must decide what they do and what they do not tell us.
And maybe as an outgrowth of our focus on standardized testing, there seems to be in some education circles a sense that if you get the formula right for teaching something, no one will fail.
There's a dream of getting rid of failure. And there's a dream that if we could just do this one thing or these three things or even these 10 things, failure would diminish significantly or disappear. If we could get rid of the worst teachers, just find those bad teachers by formula or however you want to find them and get them out of there, student performance would soar. If we could arrange the desks the right way, student performance would soar. If we did the right kind of test prep, the right this, the right that. But there is no, it's not that these things can't be done. It's not that improvements cannot be made. But education involves the subject. You have to be looking at the subject itself. There's no shortcut. You have to learn history. You have to sit down with those history books and think about the history. With mathematics, you have to ponder that theorem until it comes clear. That doesn't have to do with firing the worst teachers. That doesn't have to do with arranging the desks. That has to do with thinking about it.
So let's talk about the loss of thinking in classrooms, because kids are busy all day long. They're producing work. How is that different from actually thinking in some cases?
The problem lies in the loss of sustained thought.
Mm-hmm.
No news that we have shorter and shorter attention spans in our culture at large, and this has been discussed in many books, not just in mine. We are catering to this instead of resisting this.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that since children don't have the ability to pay attention to a long lecture, I'm not saying they should pay attention to long lectures, but it's say they get restless after 10 minutes, then schools have been breaking up the lesson into 10-minute segments so that they're doing something different every 10 minutes. Now, it's possible to do that and still keep some coherence. It doesn't have to be jittery. But what happens is they then don't learn how to listen to something that really takes more time, that requires more explication, or that may require more thought on their own part. And the lesson then, when it is fragmented in that way, it constricts the subject matter itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain subjects that you simply cannot discuss in that time, and they get pushed aside. The subject is then tailored to the structure of the lesson.
So it's almost like we decide the only things they need to know are the things that can be taught in 10 minutes or whatever that arbitrary number is.
Well, there's a focus on results all over the place and a product. So a lesson is, in many schools, not everywhere, is supposed to result in something specific that they've learned and a product that can be demonstrated, can be presented as evidence of the learning. Now, of course, you need evidence of learning. You want to see that students have learned. But many things take a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
To develop. So you have to let go of those instant results in order to have more substantial results. You have to weigh the two very carefully.
Talk about this workshop model that you write about in the book. If I have it correct, there's 15 minutes of teacher instruction and then 30 or 35 minutes of students working in these little groups. And then at the end, they all come back together and talk about what the groups have concluded.
Yes. Well, this was instituted. This came out of a program called Balanced Literacy and a number of other related programs that they were based on the idea that students should be learning from each other and they should be discovering the subject matter to some degree on their own, mm-hmm. and that the teacher's presentation should be only a small portion of the lesson so that there could be then a long period of active learning.
Mm-hmm.
So then this was mandated in New York City schools around 2004, earlier, but really it was 2004 when schools started telling teachers that they should all be using this model.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not mandated quite as much. It's not a universal mandate, but many schools still have it. So the teacher gives a brief mini lesson, and then after that there's group work usually, sometimes independent work, but usually group work. And then they come together for about 5 minutes at the end to pool together what they found and learned. Now, for some lessons, that works brilliantly. It's a very good model for certain lessons where the group work is essential to the actual topic. I taught a lesson where my students were reading the Constitution and learning about how a bill becomes a law. And we had a mock session of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And these were English language learners, and they brought their proposed bills to class and had some wonderful debates about them. And so the workshop part was actually a session of Congress.
Perfect there.
It worked very well. But to lead up to that, we had lessons that were not workshops because they needed the information.
Mm-hmm.
They really needed to take that in. So workshop model has its place, but when it is every day, every subject, then there are things that you simply can't do that you need to do. And the problem also is that students lose the ability to listen and the appreciation of the value of listening. Listening to something is not a passive activity, as we've been told over and over that in the bad old days, the teacher talked and the student listened,
mm-hmm.
and took notes. And now we want to move beyond that passive role of the student and have the student be active. Well, listening is active. There's really nothing quite as electrifying as listening to a good lecture when you know that the professor or the teacher has insights that you want that you want to contrast with your own thoughts, and you're listening and you're thinking, oh, this reminds me of this. I want to look this up in the book again, and now I have this question, and now these things came together. And to take that away or to put it down as passive learning is simply an impoverishment of education. We need that as well as the workshops.
My guest is writer Diana Seneschal. She's a former teacher in New York City public schools and author of the forthcoming book Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture. It is the winner, and she is the winner of the 2011 Hyatt Prize awarded by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, to which she will lecture tomorrow evening. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a brief pause from this discussion with Diana in order to speak once again with Jeff Whittington, who is host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know and senior producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. So remember last hour we started with a $20,000 goal for both hours of Think
I
today.
I remember, yes.
We made some great progress thanks to many of you. $16,295 left to go to make the goal for the show today. Imminently doable if you will be the next one to call 888-694-6931. Or if you will go online and make your contribution safely and securely at kera.org. And we're going to thank you, if you so choose, this hour with your very own copy of Diana's book, Republic of Noise. You can pick that up with a contribution of $10 a month as a sustaining member, or $120. It actually comes out early next month. So we'll be happy to thank you with a copy of the book if you're interested. Just call 888-694-6931 or go to kera.org.
We have knocked down our remaining amount to raise in Think today to $16,175. Every contribution makes a difference. There are so many of you listening right now who have maybe thought that it would be the right thing to do to support public radio, and for whatever reason, just haven't taken the time to do so. It takes very little time. If you go online to kera.org, you can make a straight contribution right there with a debit or credit card, or you can set up one of those sustaining memberships, which basically you just say how much you want to give per month, and that's what happens. It just it's kind of a set it and forget it, Ron Popeil sort of way of belonging to the station. We like it, for one thing, because it keeps your membership current and allows us to sort of know that we can count on your support. Honestly, the more sustaining members we have, the fewer times we have to come back in and do these drives. So that's also something to consider if you are a fan of the station, not so much a fan of membership fundraising campaigns.
The number to call, 888-694-6931, or click and join online at kera.org. What are you going to get? Well, in addition to getting radio for the year and the show for the year, you can choose from any number of thank you gifts. You can check those out online at kera.org. If we stay on track, as we've been trying to do during this drive, and to stay on track this hour, $16,175 left to raise, we're going to give you back 4 days of membership campaign free programming, because that was our commitment to you early in the drive. We said we'd like to try to make this drive 4 days shorter than normal, and it's a tangible thing, because you know how good the station sounds all the time. Even when we're in a membership campaign, the conversations are pretty great, like the one we're having today on Think. So I think it's worth maybe going ahead and making that call right now, because doing it right now does actually help us get closer to staying on track, closer to the goal, and closer to giving you back 4 days pledge-free on KERA.
This is an absolutely risk-free investment. You already know that you, when the product arrives that you're supporting, which is the radio programming that you hear every day and have been hearing for months, maybe years on end, you know that you enjoy it. It's not like ordering something online and you don't know if it's going to fit or if it's going to be flattering or if it's going to work for you. You know that KERA works for you. You know that you rely on the station, that you love the programming. It is a risk-free contribution to this station, and it is a contribution to the vitality of public discourse, civil discourse, and public radio in your community.
And it's so flattering. I mean, the station looks so good on you. Call 888-694-6931. Contribute online at kera.org. Get a copy of Diana Seneschal's book, A Republic of Noise. When you join the station with a $120 contribution, $16,175 left to go to stay on track to make the goal. Please be the next one. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a former teacher in New York City public schools. Diana Seneschal is author of the forthcoming book, Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture. It is the winner of the 2011 Hyatt Prize awarded by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Diana will speak to the organization tomorrow evening. You can find information about that at dallasinstitute.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now, and we have, I think it's Viral on the line in Grapevine. Hi, Viral.
Hi. First, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
I'm really fascinated by this topic because it's something education is something I hold really dear. I'm 28 years old, and I'm on my way to go back to school for a master's degree. Studying things like engineering and science in high school and undergrad, I'm curious to know, as more people are educated every generation from the previous generation, there seems to be this notion that everyone has to attain a certain level of education and learning. And if you compare that, I just compare my engineering book from 100 years ago, you know, or something that Albert Einstein written for entry-level calculus, compared to what I had to study when I was in college, I couldn't understand that entry-level calculus book back in the day when Einstein wrote it. It's had to get dumbed down over many generations. And so my question is it reasonable for, as more people enter learning in higher education, is it reasonable for us to have this expectation of all children that they can attain this level of intellectual curiosity, because active learning at the end of the day requires intellectual curiosity to be successful.
What do you think, Diana?
Thanks.
Thanks so much for your call.
You have posed one of the most difficult questions and one of the most controversial ones, whether all students should be encouraged to excel in every subject or whether we should recognize that some are better at some subjects than others and some more inclined toward advanced study than others. And at the university level, there have been many efforts to bring more students, as you know, into the sciences, into engineering, into physics. And so that has taken the form of transforming the lecture, which may be very challenging and demand a great deal of attention, into something that's more that involves the student more from the outset, workshops with clickers and other devices that where the professor can then gauge how much the students understand and modify the instruction so that those who aren't understanding then understand on the spot. And the trade-offs are severe. So we have a paradox here where we are trying to make the subject accessible to all students, but we are, as you yourself suggested, modifying the very subjects in order to do so. So what is happening? What are they actually learning as they and it may not all be a negative trade-off. So there may be something to be said for gauging students' understanding in the moment in a physics class. And if you realize that half of the students aren't getting what you're saying, then it is good to know this and to be able to modify your lecture or your instruction. But on the other hand, there's a great cost to this in that any difficult subject like physics or engineering requires a bit of wrestling with things you don't understand at first, and that it is not a horrible thing if you're sitting in a lecture and you don't understand everything that the professor says. You then go back and think about it. But who are the students then who think about it? Is everybody going to think about it? No, because they don't want to. So I hate to say it, but my answer is the subject at the college level should be for those who are interested in it. There should be no attempts to motivate students who aren't necessarily interested in it. And that's how it should be. But the problem there is that students are entering college with a below college preparation. Mm-hmm. So they're really getting the tail end of high school or lower than that when they enter college. They really aren't ready to decide which subject interests them the most. So because we have been dumbing things down successively over so much time, it is very difficult then to cut students off and say, well, you are not made for physics, so don't take it. No. So I understand the impetus to bring more students in and to make it possible and approachable for them. But what we really need to do is start in the younger years, push up the level from the younger years, which is so that students graduate high school with true competency and then in college can pursue the subjects that most interest them and to which they're most inclined.
Well, you know, a challenging subject like physics takes us back to this issue that some topics, some subjects may lend themselves very well to working in these groups where the teacher mm-hmm. starts and then the students take over. You know, I'm not sure that there are too many 10th graders that can lead a mini lesson in physics for their peers without a lot of instruction from the teacher first.
Well, and certain things can be done. It's not – the problem lies in absolute declarations uh-huh. that the lecture is obsolete, for instance, that we can't have lectures anymore, that we're heading into a new age uh-huh. where the old forms of instruction are outdated and must be discarded, and now we're all workshops and all engaged and all excited and all together. That's the fallacy. I've actually seen some wonderful physics classes that were workshops combined with instructions at the school where I'm now a curriculum advisor. I saw a lesson yesterday and it was quite exciting, and this was eighth graders. But you can have workshops, you can have labs, and you can have lectures. Mm-hmm. And you must not sacrifice that part that requires the sustained thought and really the concentration on difficult problems.
You write that we run the risk of mistaking distraction for engagement. Can you talk about the difference?
Yes, because engagement, we have a funny split definition of it. Mm-hmm. One idea of engagement is that we're always electrified.
Right, right.
That we're excited by whatever is going on, not feeling bored. Mm-hmm. But then there's a different kind of engagement that may involve some boredom, that may involve some confusion, but it's really a kind of a loyalty to the subject, an ability to stick it out.
Self-discipline
and perspective, and a certain sense that there's something here that's worthwhile. So that kind of engagement is not so much dependent on how we feel right at the moment. It allows for ups and downs, but it's the kind of engagement it's like being engaged to someone for marriage. It says, I'm here with this subject for the long haul.
Right. This is a commitment.
Yes, mm-hmm. This is a commitment.
Why don't we trust our kids to make that commitment anymore?
I say we don't ask it of them. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of trusting. They need to see examples of it, and they need to learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. And there too, that's where the fragmented instruction can send the wrong message to children, because it's telling them, I'm going to talk for 10 minutes because after that, it really isn't very interesting. You'll get bored.
Yeah. Yeah.
And instead, we should be able to talk to them for a bit longer, have them see how interesting it can be when one goes into a little bit further and sits past that time period.
Mm-hmm. Talk about this. One of the sort of hallmark complaints of group work that students have is some kids do a lot of work and some kids get off scot-free. Is that a valid concern?
Indeed. Oh, mm-hmm. it's one of the biggest complaints, and it's certainly a valid concern. There are students who do most of the work, and there are those who just ride along. But there are other problems as well. And so there are also students who are very quiet and thoughtful mm-hmm. who don't get their voice in group work because someone else has a take charge personality and leads the whole thing. And the person who's saying nothing may have some concerns or some very good questions that would then call into question what the group is doing. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating book. It's an old book, and I consider it a classic in the social sciences, called Groupthink by mm-hmm. Irving Elyanis. And it was originally titled Victims of Groupthink, and it was published in 1972 and then a later edition in the 80s. And he shows how policymakers working in groups often made decisions with disastrous consequences because of their group dynamics, because they didn't want to upset the cohesiveness of the group. Hmm. There's this sense of people getting along. And you sense that in group work with students as well. They want to get along. They want to fit in. And so those very good questions that might be unpopular, uncool, or that might prevent the group from getting things done as quickly as they want to get things done might not get raised. Now, there are certainly ways of addressing this, and people will come back and they'll say, well, the problem is that students need to learn how to work in groups. But to know how to work in groups, you also need to know the subject. Mm-hmm. There is a mistaken idea that you can simply teach group dynamics and then the students will work well together on mathematics or work well together on literature or whatever it might be. No, you also really need to know the literature.
Mm-hmm. So you have to have something to contribute before you're able to really get anything out of it.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Indeed. And that's one thing that I admire about the Dulles Institute. I had the opportunity to become acquainted with them this summer, and I joined them as junior faculty at the Sue Rose Summer Institute for Teachers. And there it was all about immersion in the literature. And there were lectures and there were panels and there were seminars every day. And what was wonderful was you never thought about the process. Hmm. There were many different processes, many different formats, but they all matched the literature. They all supported this peering into the literature, looking farther and farther.
So it really was engagement in the best possible sense.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When you talk about your ideas, the ones that are contained in this book with other teachers, do they light up and go, oh my gosh, this is exactly what we've been talking about?
Yes, that's happened quite a few times. Sometimes the feeling that people are just going to fall backwards in their chairs and say, yes. But then there are others who know that they're devoted to the idea of group work, mm-hmm. and they're devoted to the idea that something new is happening, that there are some kind of the kinds of pedagogical models that are now being developed or now being implemented or mandated are somehow a welcome break from the past. But really, if you look back in history, you see that these are not new models. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, again, this idea of solitude is being able to embrace the past as well as the present also involves some respect for the past. When we pride ourselves on our newness all the time and think that what we're doing is new, and associate new with good. Mm-hmm. The education philosopher Michael John Dimashkevich wrote quite wittily about that. He said that, you know, the ancient Greeks, they had many different words for one meaning, and we kind of have the opposite. We, for a single word, we might have several different meanings, and one example is the word new, which we use to mean both itself, new, and also good. Huh. So why should new mean the same as good? And G.K. Chesterton wrote that, you know, although today has always been today and yesterday, and though the moment is always modern, we are the only people who have prided ourselves on the fact that today is not yesterday. That was almost a century ago, but that still holds true. This stuff is not new, and good teachers have combined methods over the centuries. It's just what a good teacher does.
Diana Seneschal is my guest. She's a former teacher in New York City Public Schools and author of the new book, Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture. Diana is the winner of the 2011 Hyatt Prize awarded by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, which will host her lecture tomorrow evening. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back in the room now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Great news. $15,610 left to go on our $20,000 goal for the Think Show today. That means we've heard from some of you. Thank you to Stephen Huffman in Alito, Carter Beckworth in Springtown, Elaine Sprague in Dallas, and Pamela and Donald Doan in Cleburne. They all called 888-694-6931. Again, the number, 888-694-6931. Or they went online to KERA.org, clicked and joined the station there, and helped KERA stay on track and helped us make our mini goal for the Think Show today.
This is such an engaging topic for so many of you. We know that education and ideas about how people should learn and interact with ideas are fascinating to you, our audience. If you would like to receive a copy of Diana's forthcoming book, you will be one of the first to receive it, actually, because it is coming out early next month, Republic of Noise. We have it available as a thank you gift at the $120 contribution level. available. So you can either do that all at once, or you can sign up for the sustaining membership plan and just do $10 a month, and this can be your thank you gift.
Yeah, it's so easy to do, and right now is a great time to do your part for the station. You know, you hear something interesting, you learn something new every day on Think, every day on KERA, and that's why we think, and you know what, you probably think it is too, worth your support. You've listened maybe for years. Why do we know that? Well, because people who join tell us, you know, I listened for years before I finally gave. I'm so glad I joined the station. I mean, everybody says that. So, you know, just go ahead, make the call, make the online contribution. Again, we have $15,000. Now it's $500, $15,550 left to raise in this hour to make our goal. It was a big goal, $20,000 for the two-hour Think Show today. But you know what? We're trying to wrap this drive up sooner than normal. We're trying to give you back 4 days of interruption-free programming. If we can wrap it up tomorrow, that's what we'll be able to do. That's why it's urgent. We're in the countdown mode right now. We're waiting to hear from you and your call to 888-694-6931. Your online pledge at KERA.org takes you off the list. We won't be talking to you anymore once you make your contribution.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. The online spot is KERA.org to make your contribution. If you listen to this show, if you listen to all of public radio on a regular basis, you realize that it is a full-time job for us to present this content to you. I think, if we could do it part-time and not work full-time here, perhaps we would do that. But it's at least a full-time job for Jeff and me and for just about everybody else who works in public radio to present to you content that has been thoroughly researched. We present to you guests that have been thoroughly vetted, people that we think that you will find interesting and engaging, and I'm now afraid to use that word a little bit, but engaging in the good sense, like Diana Seneschal, like Chuck Palahniuk in the last hour. This is a job, and we are delighted to do it, but your support makes it possible for us, for this, these jobs to exist, for us to present this content to you.
Yeah, the station only exists because people have given money to the station. I mean, that's the cleanest way to say it. The only reason KERA has been on the air, the radio station has been on the air since 1974, is because people who listen to the station sent money in. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal. And, you know, we don't take it lightly that you give $120 or $240 or $1,500 or $3,000 to the station. We know how much money these contributions are to you. It's up to you to decide. We just, you know, you've already decided. You already listened to the station. You've thought about it. So why not join Brendan Bass in Dallas? Why not join Ann Hines in Dallas or Tina Bowers in Rowlett or Lindsay and Aaron Wright in Flower Mound? They did their part. So why not you? The number to call, 888-694-6931. Or go online and contribute at KERA.org.
$15,000 left to raise during Think Today, $15,035. $207,000 left until the drive is over. We love your support at 1-888-694-6931 and at KERA.org. Back in 2 minutes with Diana Seneschal.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Diana Seneschal. She is the author of the forthcoming book Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture, and the recipient of the 2011 Hyatt Prize, awarded by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk about this. You write about this phrase, this idea, out-of-the-box thinking. And the fact that, first of all, it's very hard to define. And it made me think a little bit about being told in, you know, fifth grade that E.E. Cummings had to understand the rules of grammar and punctuation before he was allowed to break them. Is it the same for this out-of-the-box thinking idea?
Well, the out-of-the-box thinking, we often hear about it in the abstract, and it's the same problem with big ideas and critical thinking and creative thinking and problem solving.
It all sounds great.
It all sounds wonderful, but what on earth does it mean?
Uh-huh.
And yes, indeed. You can arrive at many more interesting ideas through sinking into the subject and really working through a problem that already exists, which then triggers thoughts about other problems and so forth, or making your way through a sonnet and seeing how the pieces fit together, and you then understand what a sonnet is. And when you go and write one, you're alert to these things. Mm-hmm. So that when we hear so many calls for this kind of out-of-the-box thinking, well, you know, why doesn't somebody think about which box it is and how this box is actually shaped? And why not take some time looking at the box or the polygon, the polyhedron, the dodecahedron, or the thing that is shaped has little curves this way and that and alleyways this way? And if you are reading the Iliad, mm-hmm. you come with many thoughts that are, I would say, creative thinking, problem solving, critical thinking, all those things. Why not start with reading the Iliad?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Marie in Frisco. Hello, Marie.
Hi. So I appreciate this conversation. And one of the things that was running through my head was, how does your guest's philosophy of education compare with Montessori or Waldorf schools? Particularly because this seemed to be geared more for the younger kids and seemed to have a stopping point. So like a high school student wouldn't necessarily be in Montessori. So where does the progression go?
Oh, the progression is very natural at the high school level. It's simply a matter of taking time with the subject. I don't think there's anything fancy in it. It doesn't have to be a particular model. And I resist the idea of needing to espouse this or that educational model. What we're doing is looking at the subject. So, for instance, you have a literature class. The format is so simple. You read the literature and you come together and discuss it. And perhaps the teacher gives a lecture one day to draw attention to certain aspects of the novel or the poem or what it might be. But the other times you're discussing it as a class, and the teacher leads the discussion and asks challenging questions and brings out different parts. And then the same thing might be for a math class. The teacher might present a theorem and a proof, and then the class time will be spent looking at that proof in different ways and figuring out the different steps of it and looking at the corollaries and looking at related proofs and so forth. So it isn't anything, there is no specific approach that is needed other than looking at the subject and figuring out best how to fit that into the class time.
I have noticed in examining literature, my children have come home at certain points, and the focus is so much on finding exactly the one thing that's most important in this paragraph or this essay or something, that there's not a lot of room left to wander around and find other things that might be interesting. And I wonder what we could do to sort of bring that thinking back. Or maybe there's no time for it in class. I don't know.
There is time for that in class, and it requires letting the literature or the nonfiction reading passage, whatever it might be, lead the way. Mm-hmm. Figuring out what it's about, which requires reading it closely and thinking about it. In many schools across the country, there has been an unfortunate emphasis on reading strategies. Uh-huh. So instead of focusing on actual works of literature, the class focuses on a particular strategy. Today, our strategy is finding the main idea. Today, our strategy is prediction. Today, our strategy is summarizing or making an inference.
And nobody reads that way on their own time.
Well, yes, and not only that, but each of these strategies falls apart in specific instances. Mm-hmm. For instance, predictions, there are so many different kinds. It doesn't matter whether or not you can make a prediction. It matters whether or not you know how to do it, and it matters how you handle being wrong, because so much of mm-hmm. reading literature is about being wrong.
Being surprised.
Being surprised mm-hmm. and having your own assumptions shaken up mm-hmm. and having your own idea about what the story was, what it was about, turned around. And so you must approach the work of literature. You must take your predictions with you, but let them change and change shape and not be superimposed on the literature, not define what the literature is. And the same thing is true about the main idea. There are certain essays and articles that certainly have a main idea in the opening paragraph, and you can spot it, and that's that. That isn't really very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But many don't have a main idea that comes out that you can point to. In many cases, the main idea may shape itself over the course of the essay or the story, or there might be a few intertwined ideas, or you might have what seems to be a main idea, but it's these side observations that are the most interesting that you must not lose.
What's so interesting about that, Diana, is that if you're writing on a standardized test and you don't start in that main paragraph with that main idea, you're going to lose points. That's what our kids are taught.
Well, that's a big problem. And another problem is that you can be saying practically nothing, but you have a main idea, you have transitional phrases, you point to textual details, and you get all the points you need on the standardized test. Mm-hmm. So standardized tests, unfortunately, follow a rubric. How can we move out of that within the standardized tests? I don't know, because so many have to be scored. But it does train students after a certain point to write poorly. Up to a certain point, perhaps, to write better, just to frame paragraphs and to state their points, etc. And then beyond that point, it's really bad advice and bad examples and bad practice. So what we see happening in education with the standardized testing and with so many other aspects of our education is that it pushes things towards the average, towards the low average, that the kinds of practices encouraged are not the very, very best. It's not the best thinking or the best reading or the best attention to subject matter. It's something so-so, perhaps better than nothing at all. But we don't want so-so. We don't want to squeeze everything into that so-so zone.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Eric on the line in Keller. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering what you thought about why failure is so unacceptable in public schools and community-supported colleges, being that the communities have the best to gain or the most to gain with failure promoting success.
Failure has stigma attached. Failure is uncomfortable. Failure looks bad. We live in an age of PR, putting your best foot forward, having a nice, shiny blog with everything in place and pretty pictures of yourself and so forth. And having a resume that shines and having videos where you look very, very, very confident and looking confident is all important. And people put themselves forward in so many ways that they then feel the pressure to look good when they put themselves forward. And we have so many areas of awkwardness, so many uncertainties, so many things we have not done well. But how many of us are willing to admit to those openly? So we, for the most part, do not, because we think that it would be looked down upon. And then that's the message that we send also. It's a message that we create as communities, that failures and awkwardness and slippages and big mistakes are just things that you do not talk about if you want to survive. You put on a much brighter face. And then, of course, as you suggest, that we lose this opportunity to work with the failures and learn from them. Of course, failures themselves in and of themselves do not instruct unless we actually think about them correctly and learn and work from them. But that can be done. And again, that is the kind of engagement that is valuable, is that interest in something over the long term, the willingness to work on something even when we're failing. There's a wonderful book by the psychology professor Philip Johnson Laird called How We Reason. And in one of the chapters, he talks about the Wright brothers and how it was not perseverance that set them apart from their rivals, but their ability to reason through their mistakes. And he shows this by describing their actual work. And it is by far the most interesting description of the Wright brothers that I have ever read, because it analyzes their work and how they learned from mistakes.
Diana Seneschal, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Diana Seneschal's new book coming out very soon is called Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture. It is the winner, and she is the winner of the 2011 Hyatt Prize awarded by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Diana will be addressing the organization tomorrow evening. You can find information at dallasinstitute.org. I want to thank all of you who have participated in this conversation as listeners, all of you who have called in and written in. And I especially want to thank those of you who have helped us get closer and closer to our goal for Think Today, trying to raise $20,000. We have $14,570 left to go. But the contributions of folks like Carol Reynolds in Richland Hills and Barbara Brown in Denton and Yolanda Allen in Dallas and Barbara Horton in Grand Prairie all have been exceptionally helpful in helping us get closer to this goal. Your contribution now will join those and make a difference for for this station. You can do it online at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. You can receive, if you are interested, a copy of Diana Seneschal's new book, Republic of Noise, The Loss of Solitude in Schools and Culture, when you make a contribution today at the $120 level or above. Hello, Jeff Whittington, Senior Producer of Think.
Hey, Chris. Hello to you, and what a great conversation. We heard from so many people. We had calls we couldn't get to, emails we couldn't get to. It's just, we normally see, it seems like we have so much time. And, you know, even in a membership campaign, when we take a little bit of time to remind you how much you love the station, we still have an incredible amount of time with a guest compared to what you would hear if one of these interviews was conducted on any other station. And that's what you get from KERA. That's what you get from public radio. And that's why we ask you to help pay for it. Our goal for the Think Show today, $20,000. We've made some great progress. We're getting close to having raised $6,000, Chris. $14,290 left to raise. But your contribution right now will help us get there. And you know what? We really still can get there. Don't leave it up to somebody else. You know, what if somebody else doesn't do it? It's really up to you to make the decision. Pick up that phone and call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
You know, we're not planning to go anywhere, but just imagine where you would go to find all of the content that you receive on KERA if we weren't here. And at that point, you would pay any amount of money to get the station back. We're not at that situation right now, but we do rely on your support to make this possible. You know, Jeff, when you talked about the fact that even during the fundraising campaigns, we have more time with each of our guests than you would get anywhere else on the broadcast spectrum in North Texas. That's not because you and I want it that way, Jeff, although we love it this way. We do that for you. We do that because we know that this is what you want. This is the kind of programming that you have told us you respect, you want to engage with, you find compelling. This service is provided for you, and we therefore rely on your support. It would be easier to sort of run a commercial station and do things for 2 minutes at a time and not have to worry so much about coming to you directly, but that's not the way we've chosen to do things because you want a certain kind of programming. You want an hour-long interview with a compelling guest. Your support is why we're able to do it. Please go now to kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. Make a contribution in any amount. Maybe you want to be a Friends member. Maybe you want to just drop in an additional gift. Maybe you're already a current member. Maybe you just want to send another $20 or $50 our way. Whatever amount works for you, we appreciate.
$14,290 left to raise in our goal for the Think Show today. You know, I'm not optimistic that we're going to make it in the last few minutes of the show, Chris, but what we're giving you is the opportunity to really have an impact on how long this membership campaign is. We started the drive with a guarantee that if we, if we could get there by tomorrow, we'd end the drive what would essentially be 4 days earlier than normal, giving you back 4 days, days that we don't have to come on the air next week during the show, during the Diane Rehm Show, during Morning Edition, Fresh Air, The Think Show, all the shows, and ask you to support the station. And we've made really great progress at staying on track. But this goal this hour is designed to keep us on track for that. So if you've considered making a larger gift to the station, maybe it's time for you to renew your membership at the Friends level, $1,500. Maybe you can give a little bit more than that. We have had contributions of $3,000 or $5,000 before. And you know what? The door is not closed yet. We still have a few minutes left to try to make this goal of $20,000 for the Think Show today. Just pick up the phone, call 888-694-6931. Make a contribution at whatever level is right for you. That's what's so great about public radio. That's what's so great about KERA is you get to decide what the station is worth, and you get to decide to make that call, to make that online contribution.
And you know that it's the right thing to do because you are a listener to the station. You are an intelligent person. You, as we love to say around here, are a lifelong learner, and that's why you are a listener to KERA. So you know that it costs money to put the station on the air. You're not under the illusion that somehow it's able to exist for free. You understand that there are bills to pay, that this is a not-for-profit organization, that we raise only the money we need to provide you the programming that you have come to count on. And you also know we're not kidding when we say that we need the money. When we you know, ask for your money, you know, $100 and $200 and even $1,500 at a time. That is, in some ways, a less efficient model than if we found some giant sponsor somewhere and had a corporation put a lot of commercials on the air. But we feel like this is a really honest way to ask for money from you, to and you're able to listen to exactly how your money is spent.
I mean, ultimately, it's better for you because there's no one's interest being served here other than yours. That's what public radio is all about. No one's killing a story on this station because they're a big sponsor and they didn't like the angle. You know, and that's what you get with public broadcasting, not-for-profit media. You get actual fair and balanced coverage of the issues. And you get people on this show who come on and we ask them questions and they tell us what they're thinking. That's what it's all about. That's what we're asking you to support. The number to call is 888-694-6931 or go to KERA.org, make a contribution there. $14,290 is what our screen is showing, is still left to raise in our goal for $20,000 for the Think Show today. So we're still waiting to hear from you. The number 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org.
The other great benefit is because of your support, we're able to bring you an hour with the likes of a fascinating, highly qualified guest like Diana Seneschal, whose book Republic of Noise is available as a thank you gift. Fascinating book, may not make the number one New York Times bestseller list, but is worthy of conversation, and we know that you've enjoyed the conversation. Show that support by going online now and making a contribution at KERA.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. Thank you.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.